You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of May, 2018, on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House. I'm Daniel Bache. Coming up,
we've developed a great relationship with China, other than the fact that they've been killing us on trade for the last long period of time. Killing us, absolutely killing the United States on trade.
The United States sends a trade delegation to Beijing, but with state media warning against American bullies, has the goodwill already evaporated from the negotiating table? I'll ask my guests, Linda Yu and Alessio Patilano. Also ahead, thawing relations with North Korea might sound encouraging, but remember those human rights violations.
At the end of the Second World War, so many people said, if only we had known, if only we had known the wrongs that were done in the countries of the hostile forces, if only we had known that. Well, now the international community does know.
We'll ask whether the diplomatic agenda ought to undergo a rethink. Plus, Amazon dictates tax policy in its home city, and Trump, the movie. Too soon? That's ahead on Midori House, starting now. My guests today are Linda Yu, broadcaster and author of The Great Economist, and Alessio Patilano, lecturer in War Studies, King's College, London. Welcome both to the program again. China is ready to stand up to bullying by the United States, if necessary. That was the line coming from Chinese state media today as a trade delegation from Washington touched down in Beijing. This is just a short two-day summit, but while some may be receiving this visit with high hopes, most view the likelihood of a breakthrough deal with considerable skepticism. Donald Trump, we heard off the top, says China is killing the U.S. He's earned himself a reputation as a bit of an undisciplined cowboy. He's not, far away from being a bully himself. He's heaping praise on Xi Jinping today. But how difficult a task has he given the U.S. Delegation heading into Beijing? Linda, maybe we'll start with you.
Well, it's going to be hugely challenging, but clearly quite a lot is at stake because it's in nobody's interest to escalate this into a trade war. I think what they're going to have to try and get China to do is to open up China's markets more because you can reduce a trade deficit in two ways. You can either reduce imports or, better, to sell exports. And I think on this front, China is not in a great position because it's not just the Americans, it's also the Europeans and other parts of Asia who have complained that Chinese markets are not as open as their own markets when it comes to what China is trading. But I don't think you're going to see a great deal of progress just because the Chinese are so worried about being dominated by Western firms. But that being said, whenever you have these massive trade delegations, you do always expect some degree of progress. But we should bear in mind that when the Americans and the Chinese meet, sometimes they walk away really with nothing to show for it. And that's actually pretty unusual, but that really underscores how fraught the tensions are between the U.S. and China. And just a little anecdote around this particular trade delegation. Peter Navarro, who is the head of the new National Trade Council set up by President Trump specifically to look at trade, he's written a book called Death by China. He's obviously very worried about trade with China and how China's evolving. It's his first trip to China.
Interesting. Well, we'll see if he comes away happy then after his first trip. You mentioned China may be not in the greatest position here, but they all also have huge interest in staying in the U.S. market. Alessio, what cards does China hold in this negotiation?
Not that many. It's not a good place, and President Xi doesn't really want to be in this situation. He's got, he's a man that on one hand has invested an incredible amount of time and effort to position himself at the center of everything in China. He's the man in command, he's the man in charge. On the other hand, he's got very limited leeway in terms of convincing everybody else, particularly in the business sector, to give way to that opening up that would allow to counterbalance any sort of imposition tariffs coming from the United States. So he's in a very uncomfortable place right now, because I think there's very little that he can give to this delegation. This delegation is coming to Beijing with a degree of expectation, but he knows two things. First of all, that the 6.8 growth in terms of GDP that China has been showcasing. Well, first of all, it comes from Chinese sources, and the Chinese like to play around with figures so that they look very round. But what's behind them, nobody really knows. I have my own sort of personal experiences interacting with the Chinese. They have a very interesting way sometimes to come around and give you figures about stuff. How they come to those figures is an interesting question in itself. So the economy is already slowing down, and there is a promise to deliver more to the Chinese people. And the second issue there is that this is an investment-led type of economic growth, which would be problematic to maintain if you start opening the Chinese market to external goods. Also, at the moment, there is also a question that there are certain sectors that the Americans want to be more liberalised, open and accessible, where the Chinese do not have a possibility right away to close the gap between the products they can deliver and what would be sort of available in the Chinese market. Again, creating further impediments about how to close that gap, how to reach that conclusion. Xi Jinping has proved on a number of occasions to be particularly skeptical of open markets and liberal economies as a type of principle. He's a person who likes to have a plan and getting the plan in motion and moving around that plan. So none of this bodes too well in terms of how successful this meeting will be. We'll see what happens.
Xi Jinping has of late been playing a softer type of diplomacy. The U.S., not so at all. And Linda, perhaps, does China feel threatened here at all? They've got tariffs hanging over their head, but Chinese state media said they won't back down to bullies. What do you think will happen here?
Well, I think the Chinese have been doing a tit-for-tat. So every time the U.S. announces tariffs, China announces tariffs as well. And Chinese tariffs are very targeted towards members of Congress who are facing re-election in the midterm elections, who could put pressure on President Trump. But I think China would also retaliate if the U.S. escalated to the next phase, which is to restrict Chinese investment. And they've already done that on a piecemeal basis. But if they were to do that more broadly, I think China would also retaliate. And that, of course, poses huge problems, because once you start restricting investment, you affect supply chains, and that could have very damaging economic effects. But I think what you see in the state media is essentially Chinese political posturing in the same way that when Donald Trump tweets, they're killing us, the Chinese say we will stand up to bullies. I don't think that actually reflects what they're going to try to do on the ground, which is to resolve this through greater market opening, mostly on the part of China, I should say. The other thing they want, which is not going to happen, I don't think, is they want better intellectual property protection. Right. That's going to take a generation. But it's getting better because, not because of foreign pressure, but because Chinese firms have IP to protect.
Alessio, did you want to pick up?
I think there's a couple of very good points here that Linda just mentioned. The first one really is this idea of posturing. When the Chinese are starting to say, like, oh, we're going to retaliate, what they really are saying is, like, we're really worried about this. So that's one element of the story, which is quite interesting. The more the Chinese press, particularly the main official news outlets, start chest bumping, it means that they are worried. There is a palpable tension, because they know that there's very little room to maneuver around this. And the second point is also that there is already something that is changing. I think the intellectual property question is a very important one. And it will also connect to some of our other practices, particularly in advanced tech, whereby we've seen in the United States a number of restrictions have been imposed on leading Chinese giants, Huawei, ZTE. These are big names. But at the moment, there is a serious sort of question as to their practices. practices, the importance and the influence of the party as a component of the board of these companies, its impact in that sense, and how the business model actually has issues that raise security concerns in the United States. Mm-hmm. This is something that started in the United States, but is creating sort of reverberations well beyond the borders of the United States, even here and in Europe, across Europe. There are a number of questions raised. So what we're looking at is a situation whereby the United States is becoming, if you want, the front runner of a series of problems. After a number of years welcoming the interaction with the Chinese economy, Chinese business, now people are starting to raise concerns as like their practices. Mm-hmm. And so I think what is happening in the moment is something that is very specific to the US and China, but the implication of which will be far beyond that sort of bilateral relation, which is also why everybody's looking at it mm-hmm. with such a keen eye.
Yeah, lots going on there. It'll be fascinating to watch, as Linda mentions, the massive trade deficits and the intellectual property as well. I want to stay in the region, but I want to move on now to North Korea. Much has been made of the thawing relations between the North and the international community. Today, Kim Jong-un even told the Chinese diplomat that he's committed to the full denuclearization of the peninsula. But there's another side to Pyongyang's diplomatic U-turn that's faded from view recently. In 2013, a UN inquiry found that human rights abuses in North Korea were far beyond what many had imagined. The chief investigator, retired Australian Justice Michael Kirby, compared the scale of abuses with the Holocaust. We heard that off the top. Are these promises of denuclearization making it tempting to forget about the details of that UN report, Linda?
I'm afraid the UN report probably is not front and center of any of the mm-hmm. leading policymakers' minds, and it is a shame. I mean, I think this is one of the real problems with North Korea. I think, well, there's lots of problems with North Korea, but I suppose, you know, if, and this is a big if, because remember, denuclearization has been promised at least twice before by Kim Jong-un's father over the past decade and a half. If you make the first step towards removing nuclear weapons and you have, say, normalization of relations, will you be able to move on to the second step? And I think North Korea is so unpredictable that, yes, of course, human rights should be top of the agenda when Donald Trump, if Donald Trump, mm-hmm. meets Kim Jong-un. But I think most people don't necessarily believe that this dismantling of their nuclear sites. Mm-hmm. Kim Jong-un has said they've already started, because remember, he was going to do this in May this month. I think there's quite a lot of skepticism that even this step will happen, which makes any negotiation with this, I don't even know how to describe North Korea, mm-hmm. Just extremely difficult and unpredictable.
China has been the biggest backer of the North, but they've been angered in recent years. But they're pushing, as well as Japan and the U.S., for this to be a peaceful relationship between the North and South. Have economic interests, though, of China sort of put all of this aside as well, the human rights that we've talked about?
I think the human rights side was never really the top priority on the Chinese agenda in this mm-hmm. regard. So I don't think that will change. I think at the moment, one of the preoccupations in Beijing is that with the South Koreans and Donald Trump taking the driving seat in this process, mm-hmm. they feel like they have been a little bit sort of sidelined, you know. The foreign minister is in Pyongyang, and I think the visit that Kim did to Xi Jinping was very much about to try to mend some of the it's difficult to say burned bridges, but really like the weakened relationship that existed between the two sides. I think here the issue has two main components. One is human rights directly as on the table. No, it isn't, except perhaps if you're looking at the Japan-North Korea dimension of this problem, because of course we've got the question of the Japanese abductees, which is in a way related to the question of human rights. Indirectly, I think what is happening is that, and that's certainly the approach that the South Koreans have taken, and that is, if we manage to take North Korea on on a different path, a path that will see North Korea slowly, progressively opening up and sort of focusing on improving the conditions of the country. Indirectly, we will also be approaching the question of human rights. Is it worth putting on the table as it is front and center? No, it isn't, because it puts everything else on hold. And the second issue is what it means by what we mean by denuclearization, or put it this way, unless that question is sorted out, then it's going to be very difficult to start approaching the question of, well, how do we engage with the North Koreans? And the question of denuclearization is a lot less clear cut as it would appear on the surface, because yesterday, a couple of days ago, the official English versions that the North Koreans put out of the joint statement was released, and I was reading, and it reads very differently. As per previous joint statements between North and South, it's a very different document altogether. And the way it talks about denuclearization, it presupposes somehow that you have a Korean peninsula that is free of all nuclear weapons, which would imply also U.S. nuclear deterrent provided to South Korea, and above all, an ironclad commitment somewhere that the United States would ensure that they would never nuke the North Koreans, which is impossible to give as assurance, because if anything, most of the core capabilities are stealth submarine base and don't need to be on the peninsula to hit the North Koreans. So unless these, you know, the fine prints of the details of this is sorted out, you can't really approach any other matter. Right. So whether it is a direct or indirect approach to human rights, you basically are on square one.
You brought up South Korea's role there, and some have suggested the sort of sentimental side and the connections between North and South may make it complicated, and especially for the U.S. and Japan and China sort of getting what they want, and that's to get rid of the nuclear weapons first and foremost. Is it then falling on Seoul to take care of the well-being of the North's people, or do the other players have a big part to play as well, Linda?
I think everyone has a part to play, but I think if some type of normalization or even reunification happens, the burden will fall on South Korea. And it's probably going to be a pretty massive burden, given how dire North Korea's economy and standards of living are. And I think one of the political challenges in South Korea is that the younger generation don't necessarily share the fervor of the older generations to reunify. And I think that's going to be one of the issues, because reunification is always costly. We can see what happened in Germany between West and East Germany. And West Germany was quite wealthy at the time of reunification, and it still exerted quite a heavy cost. If North Korea and the Korean Peninsula somehow enters the state, of course, I think there will be quite a lot of international support for South Korea. And there's already one beneficiary of the movement so far. The Republicans have nominated President Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize today on the back of his efforts.
Well, hopefully he takes up the cause of the North Korean people at the end of the day. Only time will tell, I guess. You are listening to Midori House. Here with me, Daniel Bache, Linda Yu, and Alessio Patilano. Coming up next, Down Tools in Seattle as Amazon halts construction of its new city office space. And in case reality wasn't quite enough, Trump the movie coming soon to a theater near you. Stay tuned.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
What is it like to be a city forgotten and rediscovered? Monocle Films travels to Gunsan in South Korea to bear witness to its urban revival. Here, natives and newcomers are creating quirky bars, art spaces, and a bright future for this charming coastal outpost. Gunsan, building on the past, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
This is Midori House live on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bache. Still with me, Alessio Patilano and Linda Yu. Few of us would likely claim to be fan of taxes, but Amazon, well, they really don't like taxes at all. The online mega retailer and technology company has recently been embroiled in a row with its hometown, Seattle. I need to run a city that has room for prosperous business, but doesn't do it at the expense of people getting pushed into poverty. Those are the words of Seattle City Councilor Mike O'Brien. Last month, Wall Street analysts tipped Amazon to beat Apple, Microsoft, and Alphabet to a $1 trillion valuation. But now, over what amounts to about $20 to $30 million annually, the company has frozen construction of its new building downtown and said it's reconsidering plans to move into another one. That is about 4,500 jobs. The threats are reportedly due to a tax being considered by the city. So when cities open their arms to big companies like this one, Linda, perhaps we'll start with you. Isn't this one of the downsides?
I don't think any company should be exerting this much political influence. Mm-hmm. But Amazon is a giant in a city that probably does need tax revenue. They probably, maybe, they view Amazon as a good source for it, given how fastly it's grown. But Amazon's also done this in other cities. So they have been looking at cities for their second headquarters. Mm-hmm. And they've already contacted all the cities that failed so far to tell them what's wrong with their cities. So that could either be helpful or another sign that Amazon is a little too powerful, perhaps. We should be beyond the stage of one company towns.
Mm-hmm. Well, 45,000 jobs in Seattle, vital for the city and its economy, perhaps, just as Microsoft was there in the 90s. Do they think they're getting away, Alessio, with the economic impact alone in the city?
Well, I think in a way, they're banking on that. And the fact that they've been courted by a number of different cities to host the second headquarters in itself is an indicator of the fact that they probably think that they got the power to negotiate. This could be very much a negotiating tactic. Having said so, I think the issue there is that you've got two different questions. Mm-hmm. One is improving the living conditions and standards in the city. And the other one is there's a big company that wants to come to town, and that in itself will bring changes. I mean, in London, we know all about this because entire neighborhoods in London have been demobilized and their sort of human geography and configuration had substantially changed because the economy has transformed itself, brought about higher values of properties, more difficulties for the poorer parts of the population to remain where they were. So in this respect, I think this particular piece of news is interesting in two ways, because on the one hand, it tells us something about the sort of lights and shadows of a very powerful private organization. But on the other, is also a failure of local governance. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you should see that coming if you're in Seattle and Amazon is the largest economic factor in town. So what is preventing the council to look at alternative options to improve the conditions? There's very little to be understood in that. And I think that is just as important, if you want. Because, yes, okay, you raise revenues and money. Then what? Mm-hmm. How are you going to make the city a place for everyone and not just for a few? And I think that part of the equation is just as important to address as it is the power that an organization like Amazon yields.
The member of Seattle City Council I mentioned off the top there said Amazon has created no opportunity for discussion around this, but that the company plays a major role in homelessness. Seattle actually just behind LA and New York City when it comes to homelessness. So why aren't they talking, and do they need to, Linda?
I think they certainly need to be talking. And I think this is the criticism levied at Amazon, not just in Seattle, but in other places. So Jeff Bezos' wealth is considerable. The stock market rises. Bezos, he is billions of dollars richer every day. And there's reports of workers in Amazon's distribution centers who can't afford housing and are camping out because of low pay, difficulties with accessing housing, and also the types of hours perhaps that they're putting in. So I think this is an issue that's going to plague the company. And I think it's a corporate responsibility issue that if you're unhappy with how policy is done, you should be talking. You shouldn't be stopping construction and issuing threats. In the long run, that may turn off your customers, which are obviously, in this day and age, much more footloose. We've seen them hit other companies who have really been affected by consumers saying that I don't really want to buy or support or take rides from a company that doesn't seem to be behaving in a responsible way.
Absolutely.
You mentioned this almost Amazon lottery before, where Amazon has investigated going to other cities, and they've put more jobs now in Boston and Vancouver, and Vancouver already has an incredible housing crisis of its own. I know Toronto would probably like to be involved, but do these places need to be worried then if Amazon is moving into their market in a bigger way, Alessio?
Well, again, I think the points that Linda was making are all very important. And I think this is the sort of question that, you see, only if you have a concerted effort to hold corporations like Amazon accountable for what they do, you probably see some sort of reaction to it. Customers are certainly a very important way. But so long so they can find new places where they can take their business, and their business will be welcome in larger cities, then you're reducing your ability, your sort of leverage and your ability to negotiate with them. I think Amazon is probably one of the last standing big corporations that has managed to dodge this bullet. But certainly he's not a loner on that side of the fence, but probably is the largest one that still has to sort of come to terms with that legacy. And I'm not sure about the data, but it seems at the moment that from a customer perspective, there hasn't sort of created a dent so much. I must admit also there is something about Amazon sometimes that is absolutely bizarre. You know, then the new bookshops that they opened, they described them, the way they described them was really bizarre. It's like, we opened this new concept store where people can go and explore books, and I'm like, right. so there is an element that you do wonder sometimes if they are like that because they think people are stupid, or there is a conscious business model choice with which they've been able to get away with so far. If that's the case, the more cities will complain about that behavior, the smaller the place will be left to them in terms of room to maneuver, and the quicker they'll have to come around and start thinking about that.
Well, we shall see what happens in Seattle, as mentioned, vital for the economy there. I want to just take a few minutes on our last topic today. When Gabriel Sherman picked up his pen and got to work on a book about the late Fox News boss, Roger Ailes, he managed to rattle the tycoon in a way few others have. The loudest voice in the room painted a picture of a right-wing news network led by a man who turned the workplace into his own personal locker room. Now, Sherman has been tapped to pen the script for a film about another boss who turned America into his own personal locker room, let's say, this time the President of the United States. This is a look at Trump's earlier years, considering the overexposure of Trump as a president. Do we think that's a wise decision to take him on?
Oh, it's probably very good for publicity for a film, I would imagine, if the President of the United States tweets about it. I think as it seems that it's going to focus on Trump's early years, and I'm not sure he's less exposed. You know, he's always been fairly overexposed, especially if you focus on The Apprentice and in this period. But I think, obviously, America has not seen a president like Trump, and there will be a curiosity about how he came to be. So in one sense, he's very well known. But like with all well-known people, understanding their motivations, you know, fascinates some. But I think if you're POTUS, that probably is going to fascinate a few more people just to work out how this man came about, how he thinks, and what can we expect as president.
The president has been beefing up his legal team on another fight recently. Gabriel Sherman managed to get under the skin of Roger Ailes. Linda, will he be easily rattled on this one, do you think?
I think Trump takes any comments about him pretty personally. So let's see how the screenplay looks. I think I'd be very, very surprised if Trump didn't have an opinion about it immediately. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually human nature. But the unusual thing about President Trump is that most of us perhaps would say, oh, well, that's my opinion on something. He immediately trumpets it to the world, which is very unusual for a president.
Yeah. Alessio, good publicity or bad, does it matter for the president? Is he going to mind?
I think he's probably going to mind it, but at the same time, he's proven to be some sort of rubber wall. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about the number of times that Obama at the Correspondents' States dinner has been talking about him in not the most flattering terms, shall we put it that way. Mm-hmm. Certainly, and he's been there. He was there. He was the place, was taking in. He hated it, probably hated Obama every time he was talking about him. But he survived. He's there, and he's now president of the United States. So that in a way gives you a sense of confidence and defines also the way you operate. Mm-hmm. Whether he's going to like it or not is difficult to say because we don't know what the script is going to look like. He's probably going to tweet about it. He's probably going to sort of have strong statement about it. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, he knows one thing, that there is no such a thing as bad publicity. It's how you spin the story around whatever that comes out about you that will define whether that is good or bad. So he's probably, regardless of the outcome, is going to try to make the best out of it anyway.
And I'm sure people will go to see the film in any sense. They just want to know. So perhaps it isn't bad publicity at all. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Alessio Padalano and Linda Yu, thank you so much both for being here to join us on Midori House. Today's show produced by Ben Rylan, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts, our studio manager, David Stevens. More music next, then at 1900, it will be The Urbanist with Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and we'll have more on the day's main stories, including diplomacy in China between Washington and Beijing, on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Daniel Bache. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.